You're listening to Sci-Fi TV Rewatch, episode 558. My name's Dave, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host Wayne as we continue our examination of the post-apocalyptic series Fallout. Dude, you know what I was thinking about today? Back in the early years of the podcast, you know, how you used to come over here very often, but I think we did this even when we were remote, where we'd talk about the adult beverage that we happened to be imbibing as we would go through our recording sessions. And dude, sometimes we'd be so just slurring our speech at the end and barely able. No, I'm just kidding.
I know. That one Coors Light, man, really kind of turned our heads sometimes.
But it was fun there when you were coming over and we'd get some sort of craft beer and try to get something. It was almost like we were trying to surprise each other with what we were going to come up with. Now it's like,
you say, Dave, I'm up for coming back over again.
Okay. All right.
Give back to the studio recording. Maybe. Right. I'll have to see. I have to look at my schedule.
Yeah, I was going to say probably not till the summer. But even then, it's difficult for sure. But those were some certainly some fun times. Now it's coffee and tea, I'm sure, just so we can stay awake. But.
But I sometimes have like a little glass of wine there.
Oh, okay. There you go.
You know, just harkening back to the good old days, you know.
All right. So what are you watching this week, speaking of the good old days?
Okay. Well, let's see. I already talked about Loudermilk. That's actually – I think I mentioned it before, but I think I mentioned it, saying that it was depressing. And I would like to retract that statement. I mean, there are some depressing elements in it, but there are also some very uplifting. I think overall it's a really – positive outlook on humanity and everything on the most part. But also the music in that show is incredible. Like, I've already got two new artists that I didn't really know about before that I'm kind of starting to listen to now because of Loudermilk. So that's a really good show. I like it. So the other one, I don't know if I mentioned, did I talk about Discovery, Star Trek Discovery? I don't know.
I can't keep the Star Trek shows straight.
But it's the last season of Discovery, and I had watched all the rest of it. I did not go back and watch any of the previous seasons before this. I did go back and watch the last episode of the last season just to kind of get caught up. And that actually worked really well as getting me caught up as to what was going on and everything. But an enjoyable show, like all the other. I mean, it's definitely not up there. It's one of my faves in the Star Trek pantheon, but it's a very solid show, and you know, I like it. I'll probably low-key miss it when it's gone, but anyway. The last one is finally Argylle came out on streaming, and I got to watch that, which you probably don't, I don't know if you know much about this one.
Nothing.
So it's Bryce Dallas Howard was in it. Actually, we mentioned it a little bit when we were talking about Nosedive, because this is the movie when the directors or the producers came to her and said, we'd like you for this part. She's like, listen, I'm not doing any workouts or anything like that for this part. Like, this is the body you get. And they were like, cool, you know? So I think I said back then how much I admired her stance on that and everything. And she is, I love Bryce Dallas Howard. She's great. She's such a great actress. You know, plays drama and humor just as well. But she plays a author of spy novels, and then she suddenly finds out that what she writes is very close to reality. And so now all these spies want her to finish her latest novel so they can figure out where the – I can't even remember what the big thing is. But it's made by the people who made the Kingsman movies, which I love the Kingsman movies. And this was very similar in its, you know, oftentimes cartoonish, overblown violence, but – it also has a strong beating heart. So I enjoyed it a lot. It was good.
All right. Sounds good. Well, listen, I watched another film. I know. I'm like,
wow.
Shattering.
Holy cow.
Shattering the Dave myth. And I
this,
have
this might
to
be more up. Movies than you've watched since I've known you.
I know.
An exaggeration.
Well, it's all Mary, and I've mentioned that before. She reads a lot, makes lists of things that she wants to check out, and I usually, you know, I don't want to say I balk at watching a movie, but I do take that stance where it might be like 12:30 at night, and she wants to start watching a movie. I'm like, no, let's hold it out till, you know, a little bit earlier. But anyway, it's a film that's on Netflix called Don't Look Up.
Oh, I haven't seen that one, but that's kind of one I've have been kind of had my eye on for quite a long time. Right? It's came out like 2 years ago, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Very good. Starring Jennifer Lawrence and Leonardo DiCaprio as astronomers that are trying to warn the world about a comet that is going to hit Earth and cause an extinction level event.
Is that Coen Brothers movie?
I don't think so.
Okay. There's some
famous director, but I can't remember who it is.
I'm going to look it up. Go ahead and talk.
Meryl Streep is the U.S. president, very Trump-like. And you know, if anybody out there internationally or even domestically, you should be paying attention to the current trial. Like Trump, Meryl Streep is apparently incapable of telling the truth. And it's just a fascinating black comedy that I suppose you could say that the idea of a comet hitting Earth and destroying life as we know it is just really a metaphor for, you know, the climate crisis that so many scientists are trying to warn the world about. But really good movie. Really. I mean, I love Jennifer Lawrence. I always say I'm not a big Leonardo DiCaprio fan, but then everything I see him in, like him.
He's pretty good in everything he does, I think.
Okay. Yeah. But the other show, and again, I've said many times that my wife continually surprises me, and I think I said this last week. You know, there like once or twice a week, she might fall asleep early on the couch, and I'm scrambling to find something I want to watch on my own. And I'm thinking, all right, what do I want to see that I know she doesn't? And there's really no genre stuff out there that I'm really dying to see. So I might come across a crime show. I'm like, nah, she'll like it. So I won't watch that.
All right, Dave, I'm just going to tell you this. Next time you're at this crossroads, open up Apple TV and watch Severance.
Okay, and I've seen the first couple. I just, for whatever reason, never finished.
But yeah, stick with it. It's excellent. It's so good.
Now, the other show that I started when she fell asleep is Black Sails.
Oh yeah. That's on Netflix now, right?
It's on Netflix. It originally was on Stars, and I had Stars. I canceled Stars, and I'll probably end up getting it again for the last season of Outlander, but pirate series that aired 2014 to 2017. As you said, it's now on Netflix. Dude, I'm not going to point out specifically what these three elements are, but dude, it has all three of the elements we like in the show.
Okay.
And
I know at least one of them. Well, two of them, actually.
You know all three. and I got to like the fourth or fifth episode, and I'm thinking, you know, I think Mary would like this. And, I was shocked that she liked Game of Thrones. I was shocked that she liked Money Heist. And so I told her, I said, look, watch the first episode and, you know, then we can go finish off that other show we were watching. Well, dude, I showed her the first episode. She's like, and we'll get to that other show later. So we burned off like five episodes the first night.
Nice.
So we started season two last night and just got in there. It is really good. It is really
cool. Yeah, I heard it was really – well, I guess because it was on Stars. That's why I didn't watch it, right?
Okay. And, you know, now it's on Netflix, four seasons. The main male pirate is – I forget the actor's name. Toby Stevens. He's Papa Robinson in the Lost in Space series.
Current. Well, it's not current anymore.
Well, yeah, okay. But really good. I mean, a lot of great – female characters, a lot of great male characters. They just introduced a pirate character that, oh my God, somebody needs to kill this dude ASAP. Historical drama. Many of the characters are real. And again, it's like you realize you can't go to Wikipedia to look up anything.
Right.
Because, so-and-so died. I don't want to know.
Lothbrok conundrum.
Exactly. So, yeah.
I'll never look at Wikipedia when I'm watching historical fiction ever again.
No, I hear you. So, all right, well, let's get to Fallout, season one, episode two, titled The Target. written once again by Geneva Robertson Dworet and so Graham Wagner.
Before we get started, Dave, actually, I need to say something because I went back and watched the first episode again, and there was something that I definitely noticed when I watched it the first time around, but never got around to mentioning it. So after Lucy and Monty consummate their marriage, he walks over to the curtains and wipes himself, cleanses his frontal area with the curtains. And Lucy sees it. She her nose kind of goes like, ugh. It's just this little moment, but it was so great. And when I rewatched it, I'm like, oh man, that is so freaking funny. I can't believe I've never mentioned it. So I'm like, I was determined to mention it right off the bat and get it out of my system there.
All right. And we get a lot of those reactions from her in this episode, maybe not as disgusting a circumstance, but in some cases, yes. Anyway, directed by Jonah Nolan.
I refuse to let you say who directed.
Exactly. Because I know you don't like him, so.
No, right. Oh, come on. Jonah Nolan, we'd be good buds. We'd get along famously.
The series was released April 10th, 2024 on Prime Video. All right, what'd you want to say? Or you're done interrupting me.
I'm done interrupting. It's just, I'm sure we'll talk about this. It's like her very first step into the outer world, because he's not from another vault, right? He's from the outside world, and the outside world is much different. In the outside world, they wipe their junk on your curtains. They kill each other a lot, and it's so that's a big part of what we're seeing in this episode, especially, is her kind of trying to acclimate herself to how this world works that is nothing like hers. It's much scarier, much dirtier, much nastier than the world, the very sterile world that she grew up in.
Yeah, I mean, it's all, murders and dirt,
Yeah.
So now you and I mentioned sort of offline during the course of the week, And I said to you, maybe it's me, but you said, no, it's not just me. The Wizard of Oz illusions, Lucy as Dorothy, the stranger in a strange land,
yep,
who simply wants to find her dad and return home.
Yeah.
And, like Dorothy, she's pretty damn brave. I can't remember if we know how old Lucy is. Obviously,
19?
Dorothy's supposed to be. I 16 or something, maybe even younger. I mean, even though Judy Garland was probably 30, what she was. But Maximus as the Tin Man, but in this case, Heart of Gold or Ruthless Sociopath.
So I'm going with the sociopath. Yeah, but I could be wrong.
We really have to examine, his character. And that's kind of what you see in Black Sails. Black Sails is so much like Money Heist in that there are very few, if any, really morally good characters. Now, as a viewer, you can make excuses for them and for their behavior, but in the end, you have to admit that, well, they're criminals, they're stealing, they're whatever. And with Maximus, I'm starting to think, and granted, it's only two episodes in, but so far I think we're fairly certain he's the one that put the razor blade in his friend's boot, which is what got him the shot as the squire. And now whether he actually kills Titus or simply lets him die,
right,
we don't really know, but does it matter which one it is?
No, I don't think it does at all. He definitely could. He refuses to help him, right? He refuses to call anyone or to help in any way. I assume they have those fix-up patches that make you all better right away, right?
That's what he's asking for, the stim pack.
Yeah, right. So, and he doesn't. He just sits there and just no.
Well, he goes to get it initially, and he opens the med kit, And he's got it in his hand, but Titus refuses to stop insulting him.
Yeah.
And I guess
the Titus tells him, like, you know what's going to happen to you. They're going to kill you. It's like, you should maybe let him save you first and then tell him that, you know, the dire consequences of his inaction.
Exactly. But it's almost like, Titus, you're too stupid to deserve a stim pack, you know. But
exactly. Right. Well, they're there in the first place. He's like, because he's like, I want to shoot something.
Right.
Like, you freaking idiot. Like, yeah. You know, like, you know?
Yeah, my wife is still on board with Fallout. She didn't like episode 2 as much as she liked episode 1. That line, I'm bored and I want to shoot something, didn't sit real well with her. But,
right.
You know, she's hanging in there. Wilzig, as the wizard, with his dog, CX-404, a.k.a. Toto, but, you know, of course.
The guy who plays Wilzig, he was on that show.
Yes, exactly.
He was on that show.
Right.
He was on that show.
It has four letters.
He was on the show with the plane crash and on the island.
Four letters, second letters, O. I feel like I'm playing Wordle here. But yeah, so again, you know, is that it for Michael Emerson as Wilzig? I mean, he's such a great actor. His character is great, but that appears to be it for him.
Well,
unless we get flashbacks.
You don't pull in Ben Linus to your show just to have him die off after being on screen for maybe half an hour.
I guess.
Is what I'm thinking, you know. They could have found anyone to play that part, right? Not that it was an easy role what he did, but it's just like, I mean, you know, they don't need like someone who has the instant recognition like Michael Emerson if you're just going to kill him off that quickly.
You would think so. Yeah.
And especially how much you have to pay him, right? It just doesn't make sense financially to do that.
You wouldn't think, but.
Yeah.
I try not to. Then we got the ghoul, a.k.a. the Wicked Witch. But
Maybe.
I mean,
the Scarecrow-ish, kind of.
Well, but he's the, you know, the Wicked Witch.
He's even got the little triangle nose thing like the Scarecrow.
Right, but the Wicked Witch is the main antagonist.
I don't think he's the antagonist, though.
Okay, and that's, I guess, what we'll have to see. And at first, I'm thinking, and I knew because I watched the episode first, and I took my notes, and then I sat down with my wife to watch it. And I knew as soon as she saw the scene where the ghoul stabs CX-404, I was ready for her to say, that's it, I'm done, because mm-hmm. she's a huge animal lover.
Yeah.
And then we get to the scene, which I knew was coming up, when he injects the dog. We assume that was a stim pack.
That's what brings it back
to life. And it's like, oh, so he's not a bad guy. But then you realize, nah, he brought the dog back because he thinks the dog's going to lead him to Wilzig. And
well, I mean, but I also think, like, that's, you know, Cooper Howard in there somewhere, and who, what the little we saw of him in episode 1, he's definitely a decent guy, right?
Okay, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. The other comparison I thought about later is with the Man in Black from Westworld.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
You know,
I should have thought about that one. That's
especially
a good one.
In this second episode, when, you know, when he's in the town square and he gets in the gunfight. And I guess we'd have to say at this point, I think Fred mentions it in his feedback, is he just, I don't want to say immortal, more like unkillable, because he's like a zombie or whatever. And
yeah,
certainly that would seem to be the case.
Well, he's been dead and buried on and off for over 200 years. So
yeah,
that probably toughens you up a little bit.
Yeah, no kidding. Now, the other thing, you know, you and I over the years have talked about Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, monomyth. And certainly I think we can look at Lucy embarking on a hero's journey. I mean, she...
And the Bildungsroman.
Right. Now, part of Campbell's hero's journey has that element of, you know, refusal of the call. And of course, she doesn't refuse. But I think when you start, you know, examining TV shows and even films to a certain extent that employ Campbell's hero's journey, you don't necessarily have to hit on every step the way Campbell laid out.
Well, it's a monomyth because you can apply it to loads and loads of things, right?
Right. And, you know, whether we see Wilsig as her mentor, albeit briefly, certainly she encounters these tests, whether she's going to accumulate some allies along the way, we don't know. I mean, does she have any enemies at this point? I mean, we know that the ghoul is after Wilsig, not after her. Now, he is going to kill her, or he certainly it seems prepared to kill her, but only because she gets in the way. And, oh, my God, you know, what a character she is. I mean, excuse me, sir, I'm new here, and I may not know the rules, but I think you're the instigator here. And he's just looking at her like, what?
Yeah, that is classic.
But, you know, despite all the danger warnings she gets about Philly, she heads there anyway. And I just what a wonderful character. And I think both of us, and again, we've said this, you know, over the last decade plus that we've been doing the podcast, how much we enjoy these strong female characters. And I think we're at a point now, it's hard to say that, you know, there's a dearth of strong female characters. There's a lot out there.
Yeah.
I mean, so
there's certainly more.
Yes.
Than when we started this thing.
Right.
But yeah. And she's great because again, she's like that naive innocent. But she's not, like we saw her like take people down,
Right.
She knows how to fight. She knows how to kill. That was her breaking that bottle and slashing Monty's face and gouging him in the neck, so that she's not some wide-eyed babe in the woods, but on the other hand, she kind of is, so she's just such an interesting character with that in and of itself.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and we see her, now she understands that she only has, not a very powerful weapon. She's just going to, knock him out. She thinks. But
what does he say? It's like a small drop in the very long. I gotta find
something
out
like that. Yeah. Now, why does Muldaver want Overseer Hank? And so we have
it's a very small drop in the very, very large bucket of drugs.
Yeah. So what is it she wants from Hank? His technical scientific expertise? Do they know, and I've got no in my notes, in all caps, do they know Muldaver on the surface, or do they simply know of her? I mean, clearly Ma knows Muldaver, and she's got her in her register because we see her name as Lucy's looking, for any clues as to where, her dad might be. But I think at this point we have to assume there's something about Hank's skill set that Muldaver needs. I mean, what else would it be, really?
No, I think unquestionably that's it.
So then, and again, one of the things. And again, I was having this conversation with my wife last night about so many of these post-apocalyptic shows that we cover on the podcast or that we just, watch on our own, where we don't really know what's going on in the rest of the world. We assume that this nuclear holocaust was between the United States and the Soviet Union. We see the CCCP.
Right.
Remnants of some sort of missile or whatever in the ground. But we don't know if South America was affected. We don't know what happened in Europe. So it's like you rarely find out what's going on in the rest of the world.
Right. Well, there seems like there's zero contact with the rest of the world.
Right. And that seems to be pervasive in all shows. I happen to mention that a guy in Black Sails was in The Hundred, and you know, that's, I guess, how the conversation about that got started with my wife.
So while we're talking about the world and geography, are we pretty sure that this is the Jersey Shore, which is where this takes place? I think that's where it is.
Well, see, we were talking about that last time, and
yeah, but Philly, right?
Well, but see, and that's what I wondered. You know, we see that, we know she's on a coast. Yeah. Because we see her at the ocean.
But there's no city. Like, that's why I didn't think it was New York, because it looks like an ocean coast, right? Not like the Hudson or something like that.
Well, but after, you know, a nuclear war.
Yeah, there's no other, like, islands around. Like, you know, if, like, she was on, the, you know, like, Manhattan, like, you'd be able to see Staten Island and Long Island and everything, right? Like, it's just the ocean. They're in Jersey, bud.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure of it.
Well, we're in episode one, we're meant to see that Ferris wheel in the background. And I had mentioned, you know, whether it might be Coney Island or the Santa Monica Pier.
Or Wildwood.
Okay. And so I'm not as familiar with that. So I guess my only thing is that the opening scene, aren't we to believe that they're in Los Angeles? The you know, that's where the ghoul is at, you know, Cowboy Bob or whatever is now, I can't remember his name, is doing Cooper. That kids party, Cooper in LA. So then you're positing that he's moved all the way across the country.
Yeah. I mean, he's had 200 years.
Okay.
Well, then I guess, like, was there something? Oh yeah. Because the weather guy's like talking about LA, right? There was something, I mean, for sure they were in LA in the beginning, right? Like there was, right.
Well,
they said some geographically, but that being said, I'm pretty sure we're on the Jersey Shore now.
Okay. I guess we'll have to agree to disagree on that one for now. Cause I'm thinking like with the Brotherhood of Steel, they seem to be in the West Coast Rockies or something like that. But anyway, we might get more clarity on that later. But what does Wilczek inject into his neck? And I assume,
my God, I don't know, but I was just like, don't do it. Ah, he did it.
Ah. Well, again, it's one of those things where I've seen the episode, my wife has not, and at that point she's thinking, he better not hurt that dog, he better not. I'm like, yeah, I'm keeping quiet, but I know he's gonna.
I'm not going to tell you the dog's going to be okay, but I'll tell you he doesn't hurt the dog.
Well, you know, and there's been so many times where she'll be like, just tell me, and I'm like, the dog's fine.
Yeah.
Or that, whatever the animal.
Well, I mean, they start off, he picks up a little puppy and throws him into the incinerator. I'm like, are you freaking kidding me?
Yeah.
That's how you're starting this episode. Yeah. All right, Jonah. Let's do this.
Yeah, I thought she was going to give up after that.
Man, that was brutal. It's like not even the credits haven't even rolled yet.
Right.
And they're throwing puppies in incinerators. Man.
Yeah. Now, you know, I mentioned Maximus, you know, earlier, and you know, what are we to make of him? And I agree with you. I'm leaning towards the sociopathic angle. You know, we see him and his first encounter in the knight suit. I hesitate to call him a knight because, you know, of the way he acquires the suit. But, you know, the first encounter he has.
Well, Arthur just pulled a sword out of a rock and he all of a sudden gets to be king. So,
yeah,
I mean.
Good point. Yeah. And we're thinking like, all right, well, maybe he was justified in letting Titus die so that the better man can fight evil, because we know Titus is so disillusioned, disgruntled. You know, it's almost like he wants some sort of a way to get out of it. And the first confrontation, he lets the bad guy go. And it's like, okay, you know, well,
we're labeling people as bad guys just because they, you know, has
sex with chickens.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Does that make you a bad guy, Dave? I don't know. I don't think we should be so judgmental on this show.
But then we go back to that comment that the ghoul makes to Maximus about, so this is where we are with training nowadays.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the other thing that we mentioned last week.
Yeah, I guess basic training ain't what it used to be.
Yeah.
Because you drive that thing like a fucking shopping cart.
We get some clarity on the timelines. You know, we talked last time wondering whether they were parallel. And I think since Lucy meets Maximus and the ghoul, I think we can agree at this point that the timelines
team up.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the other thing, we hear about the Great War of 2077. So we assume that that's, you know, in episode one, that opening scene at the kid's birthday party, that's 2077, which means it's now 2296. What do we make of that car graveyard? I mean, those cars are all like from the late 30s. And 40s, maybe early 1950s, but again, we just don't necessarily have any hard concrete evidence about, you know, this yeah. society and these societies.
Right.
So
right, and Fred mentions that, like, why is everything like, you know, around the, you know, kind of like technologically to us, like around the, you know, 50s, 60s, right? Or 40s, 50s, you know, in there somewhere. And it's like, I don't know. Because, you know, a lot of things are pretty advanced. Like we saw, you know, we mentioned before the robot in the first scene of episode one. But yet, you know, they have these, you know, cameras like that, you know, like they look through a viewfinder in the top and everything. It's very, very old tech for us. So.
So, the main story follows Dr. Wilzig meeting Lucy and, of course, Lucy, you know, heading into Philly to find her father. But we get that extended opening scene, you know, much of which we've talked about. But I thought of you as Wilzig and CX flee the compound and the machine gun starts firing at them. And I'm thinking, yeah. Wayne's thinking Star Wars stormtroopers. Couldn't hit the broadside of a barn.
Right. They got this big
inches.
Gun out there. And like, it's just a not a young guy, not running fast, and his dog. And, you know, they escape without a scratch.
Right. Now,
it also has a sign that says, please remain calm. Which
yeah. So we see Lucy walking through the wasteland. She enters that house and finds the family dead. And when she sees that bottle, you know, my first reaction was that these people may have committed suicide, which yeah. I think we find out is in fact what happened when Wilzig, you know, brings it up that it was, you know, maybe the most humane compound that Vault Tech ever made. And, you know, then it makes, you know, a lot more sense. But he suggests, this might be the first person, suggests she return home because he doesn't think she'd be willing to do what it takes to survive up here. And he wonders whether she'll want the same things should she adapt and survive. And to me, that's an idea that I feel is going to be of utmost importance moving forward, especially for Lucy, because that's going to be the challenge. I mean, you know, this moral and ethical center that's been ingrained in her in Vault 33 up here amidst the murders and dirt. And right. I think, you know, you mentioned a couple minutes ago, we know she has physical fighting skills. We know she's willing to kill to avoid being killed. We know she's brave. How far is she going to be willing to take it? And I think that's what Wilzig is trying to get her to consider. Maybe she gets away with her moral center intact, but I kind of doubt it. You know, I mean, we've seen this story before, but you know, who knows? Maybe she's a new character that we've rarely seen before. But I don't know. That's just one of the things I love about her. And you know, as she's walking through Philly, and you see the smile on her face because number one, she's never been outside before. You know, she's never walked into a town like this before. And you'd think, given her outfit, that everybody would be looking at her. And a few people do. But for the most part, she's ignored.
Right. You know, well, it's Philly.
Despite her good skin and good teeth. And
I mean, I think they pretty much, you know, if this is indeed Philadelphia, you know, maybe the buildings have changed, but the people are basically the same, it seems, after a couple hundred years.
Okay. And along the way, you know, we see some great scenes. Wilzig and his dog stop to rest, and we see CX go in that cave with, of course, the big hazardous waste. And they get inside, and it reminds us of Dark and the, you know, all the 55-gallon drums of radioactive waste that are hidden down there. He comes out with a severed hand that looks relatively fresh, but, you know, whatever. But what'd you think about the dude working on the crude water filtration system? Nice outfit, huh? What the hell?
Man.
Yeah. I mean,
it looks like a big diaper.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah. And I don't know about you, but I was kind of surprised she didn't take him up on his offer to, you know, move in. All this can be yours.
Yeah.
And again, she's
very
like,
tempting.
Very
super
tempting.
Yeah.
But thank you.
As you tell my daughters, if you are ever approached by a guy wearing a diaper, then do not accept his hand in marriage. You know?
Yeah, at first I thought that was Steve Zahn, but it of course, I forget. I looked the guy up, but wasn't Steve Zahn. But okay. Like you said, who, you know, there's so many people, you know, in this series. But, you know,
but again, they're not going to get Steve Zahn for just one little scene.
Well, you never know. I mean, you never know. I mean, you're paying them for, you know, a couple days work, and they get to be part of this prestige drama that you know, is, I'm guessing, well, especially given the fact that it's already been renewed for a second season, it certainly must be doing well for Prime. I think I read somewhere it's the number two watched show on Prime over the last week, something like that. But we see her looking around, and it's just the newness of the experience is pretty overwhelming for her. But we notice the ghoul sitting in a chair along the streets.
Right.
And again, like I mentioned before, we know he's not after her.
Right.
But, you know, she's going to get in the way, as we said. Everybody knows who Moldaver is. Get out of here. Ma tells her,
yeah.
The second person to tell her to go home. But again, you know, that thing that Ma tells her about the vaults were nothing more than a hole in the ground for rich people to hide in while the rest of the world burned, which is probably pretty true. I mean,
yeah.
We don't know. And again, this is how, you know, how the conversation I had with my wife about these post-apocalyptic tales. Well, how did these people on the surface survive? You know, where did they come from? And I was like, well, you know, I think even in reality, in a full-scale nuclear war, some people are going to survive. And that's, you know, we got into the whole thing about, well, you know, why would they have nuked South America, or why would they have nuked, you know, whatever. So we don't necessarily get an answer about that, but
we do know that the people on the surface thought that all you dipshits were dead.
Right.
So I mean, we definitely see, like, the people on the surface have a very low esteem of, they know of the people in the vaults, but they have no respect for them at all. And in fact, she laughs in Lucy's face, right?
Right. And we know that Ma, and we assume other people besides Ma, know who Moldaver. I mean, Ma says everybody knows who Moldaver. Well, do they know Moldaver is going back and forth between the vaults and the surface? And it's clearly not just Moldaver. So when she says, we thought all you dipshits were dead, I assume the prevailing thought is that, well, nobody has come out of the vaults, so they must be dead. Because clearly the earth, at least in this place, Jersey Shore or Santa Monica Beach, it's pretty habitable. Like, one of the other things that drives me crazy, and why choose to live in squalor? Why, you know, I mean, what, nobody has any construction skills? Nobody has any, I mean, I don't know. It's just that kind of stuff drives me crazy. I mean, there's nobody that wanted to be a leader. And I mean, you know, you're not necessarily starting from scratch. There's a novel called Canticle for Leibowitz. I don't know if you ever read that or not, but it's, again, it's similar in that, you know, this order of monks, they're basically tasked with acquiring and protecting basic documents. And so much time has passed that you understand that they don't necessarily really even know what it is they have. And in fact, there's one scene where, you know, they have this revered document, which we know it's somebody's grocery list.
Yeah.
but you get into, like, we don't have to necessarily reinvent the wheel. I mean, there's got to be libraries somewhere. You see where I'm getting. I don't want to belabor the point.
That's true. I got two points here. One is that if the world ended tomorrow, would you be able to make and wire up a generator like to power your home?
Well, I probably wouldn't.
Me neither. Somebody could.
I mean,
already there's very few people today that can do it. And if a lot of them are bombed and dead, then, you know, like, or if it becomes a situation like a Mad Max kind of world where, you know, the strong and the stupid survive because they're strong, you know, like you could see where, like Albert Einstein said, you know, like, I don't know what weapons the next war will be fought with, but the one after that is going to be fought with rocks and sticks, you know.
Well, okay, now, that's a fair point for sure, but I think in reality what we'd need to do is we'd need to head over to Scott's neighborhood. He lives next to his father-in-law, and apparently his father-in-law basically makes MacGyver look like an infant. So, you know, it's like, oh, he and I will be talking about some guitar gear. Oh, yeah, my father-in-law, he rewired this and rewired that, and, you know, he made this improvement, and I'm like, all right, cool. So, but my point is, a good leader would be able to find somebody that could do that. I mean, all of the smart people can have been killed. So anyway, again, it's not.
I mean,
not,
I'm just saying when something as you know as devastating as this nuclear war happens, you know, like a regression in society is something you'd expect, right? What happened when the Roman Empire in the West fell, right? Like, what happened to learning and knowledge and everything? Like, just they went back like a couple centuries.
Well, it did, but I guess my argument would be that at that time, you know, the repositories of knowledge were few and far between. So, you know, you burn the library at Alexandria, and well, that might be 25% of the world's knowledge.
Right, but you know, another point is that not only if something happened now, not only could I not make a generator, right? But well, I mean, I could build a fire. Would I be able to hunt? I don't know. There was a couple rabbits in my backyard today, were just sitting there, so I could probably have, you know, Haas and Pfeffer for one night. But you know, so how many people would actually be able to fend for themselves and survive in that if we lose all the electricity and everything? You know, like, we're so reliant on power, right? On electricity and the internet and everything. If all that stuff went away tomorrow and we had to rely on, like, you know, our base skills of hunting and gathering, how many of us would be able to survive that?
Well, I mean, I get your point. I mean, for sure. And I mean, I wouldn't necessarily, but I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at is I just find it hard to believe there's not some figure that would like take control and say, hey, you know what? I heard about Scott's father-in-law. Go get him. Bring him here. He's going to be able to wire up the generator and get things going. And then, you know, one thing leads to another.
Well, that might be like what Lee Moldaver.
Yeah.
You know, that might be what she is, right? That the person who is
trying, you know, to get like, things going.
Exactly, right? And she's like, okay, I know this hotshot scientist who knows all kinds of stuff, but he's in the vault, so I'm going to go get him.
Well, but why kill and kidnap him? Why not explain to him, look, it's fine out there. We need you to do this.
But how's she going to do that? Is she going to knock on the outside of the vault? Excuse me, can I talk?
Well, no, she's already in the vault, right? She's posing as the...
Yeah, you know, but the way she got there was by killing all of Vault 32.
You know? Yeah, good point.
All right. She had some and like you see their what they feel about outside people anyway, like they're unclean. So she probably did it the only way that she thought they actually could accomplish it. You know?
All right. Well, there is that small point, but anyway, let's get back to Lucy and the head, which she is going to end up taking to Ma's client Moldaver, but she steals Dad's. And as Ma explains to her, as Wilzig explains it, you know, that's going to be your ticket in. So it'll be interesting to see how she gets Wilzig's head across the desert. So does she have a canvas bag she can put it in?
I really hope so.
Carry it by the hair.
Oh, no.
But again, you know, when she realizes what it is she has to do, and she takes the electric saw.
Yeah, okie dokie.
Exactly. And she's going to do it. And again, yeah, you know, you say, well, would I be able to wire up a generator? Would you be able to cut somebody's head off? I mean,
yeah.
I guess in this environment, in this situation, I guess you do what you have to do. I mean, he is dead after all, but still, I mean...
Dude, I couldn't shoot a squirrel with a BB gun.
Yeah,
so,
I don't
know if I'd have. But of course, that was not in a post-apocalyptic world. If it were so, I might shoot that squirrel dead. Right. But I'm not great at taking life at all.
No. But before he dies, he tells her, you will change the future if you can bring me to Moldaver. Not my whole body, just my head. So whatever it is in there, we assume Moldaver is expecting it. So I guess before he got his foot shot off, the plan was for him to walk to Moldaver and assume that she has some means of extracting whatever it is he injected into himself. But that's where the episode ends. And I think the next episode's titled The Head. Is that what it is?
Yeah. Yeah. The next one's called The Head. Yeah. Okay. So,
anyway, what else?
Well, Wilzig like knew about her, right? I mean, he knew that she was from the vault. He knew her name. And she's just like, how do you know all that? So there's obviously a big element of mystery there.
And, well, he's got contact with Moldaver, and we know Moldaver must know who her father is.
Yeah, but I mean, I feel like it's more than that, though. You know?
Okay. Like,
but
which would be cool. Yeah, I mean, I love that intrigue.
You know, Lucy getting, like, the coordinates for to find Moldaver, like, that's a very video game type thing. Though, again, I still haven't played this one. Every time we talk about this, I'm like, I really want to play this game. I get Brendan to come home for a little bit and bring his PlayStation home with him. Something. Oh, the cockroaches.
Oh yes,
bro. Oh my god.
And the mutant bear was pretty frightening as well. Bear. But I think the cockroach was worse.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, when Titus just says, you know, fuck, when they're in there, that's like, we know things got to be pretty bad. If you're in like a huge metal suit with like weapons and everything and you think the situation's bad, it's probably pretty bad. But why didn't they just leave then, right? Why is, and then, you know, and his cowardice is almost galling, right? He's the guy in the big metal suit, but he's going to send Maximus ahead to go check out and see what's up there. I'm like, that's why, I mean, I don't honestly really, like, we're calling Maximus a psychopath, but if I were that guy's squire, I have a feeling I'd let him die too.
Yeah. No, I hear you.
Like, F that guy. He was a complete a-hole. Though it was awesome to see Michael Rapaport again. I haven't seen Michael Rapaport in anything in a long time, so it was awesome. He's a good actor. Oh, I think the line, you don't deserve that armor, is going to kind of be, I mean, obviously we're low-key seeing it right now, you know, like the ghoul mentions, you don't know how to handle that suit. And obviously he doesn't. He has a very harsh crash landing and everything like that. It's in the first time I've been persecuted for my scientific curiosity from the guy who was banging the chickens.
Yeah.
Two-headed cow. That was nice. All right, man. I'm good, I think.
Okay. All right, well, let's go ahead and get to listener feedback, and we'll be right back.
Hello, Dave and Wayne, and all listeners to Sci-Fi TV Rewatch. This is Fred from the Netherlands with my Sci-Fi TV Rewatch audio feedback number 324 about Fallout Season 1, Episode 2. Shortly coming back to last week's podcast first, I fully agree with you that three-body problem should get a second season. And I fully disagree with Wayne that 1899 should have gotten a second season. I thought that series was so bad, certainly compared to the high quality of Dark by Baron Bodar and Jantje Friese. So I'm quite happy that they didn't get a second season, because the chance was perhaps high you would have done a podcast about it. Let's go into the second episode of Fallout. Fortunately, the gore was much less, so that made it much better. And what I hoped that happened, indeed happened. We got a lot more of character development, which we also saw in the other post-apocalyptic game-based series, The Last of Us. I really, really, really liked the pre-opening title scenes, whereas the opening title itself with the bullet holes was also cool. But I loved the role of Wiltzig played by Michael Emerson. You wouldn't say that this guy will become 70 in September this year. I love the 40s, 50s vibe that they create. Partly, of course, due to the music of Ella Fitzgerald with the song Into Each Life, Some Rain Must Fall. I don't know why they create this kind of 40s, 50s atmosphere. Perhaps because the science that's behind it is more 40s, 50s like and not so developed in this post-apocalyptic world as it should or it could be. It gives a bit of steampunk feeling to it, a term you used already in the previous podcast, Dave. Of course, I'm very sad that this out-of-the-box thinking, well, that is how he looks like, scientist is already gone after the first episode, although we don't know what role his head will play, especially if you see what the title of the next episode is, namely The Head. I also loved the role of Ma June, played by Dale Dickey. I hope we will see her back, but probably not. I don't think they will return to the town of Philly, but you never know. I wonder what these stim packs are, probably short for stimulation package or whatever. These injections that can miraculously heal you. We see that Knight Titus is asking one of Maximus, but because he is constantly insulting him, Maximus doesn't give him that. That Knight Titus is, by the way, played by Michael Rapaport, who also plays the father in Atypical, a series also Dave watched. Later we also see the gall use it on the dog. And I also think I saw one being used in the first episode. Don't know where anymore, but I think there was one too. So what are these miraculously doing, healing, whatever, injections? And could one also heal, although he seems to be dead, Wildzich? Although being dead is also a discussion here, especially, of course, in the Gaul. During the town fight, he is shot several times. Is he wearing an armor, or is he just a kind of zombie that can't be killed, because he is already a kind of dead? Another indication for that is, of course, that he is actually Cooper Howard, we saw in the first episode, doing these cowboy children's parties, so he must be over 200 years old. I think Lucy's father must play a pivotal role somehow. He seems to be very bright, quite a scientist, as we saw in Lucy's interview, and the fact that Wincy also knows him, or he knows Lucy's last name, makes a connection, and he knows quite a bit about Vault 33 and what this Moldaver wants to do with him, because she took him hostage. So it all leads back to Lucy's father, actually. But we will see. So, okie dokie, that will be all. Greetings, all the best, Fred from the Netherlands.
Hello, everyone at Sci-Fi TV Rewatch. It's Alan from England here, mostly with feedback about Fallout Episode 2. Comments on the previous podcast, when Wayne likened the leaving of the vault to Plato's cave, I remember why I love this podcast so much. When I was watching The Last of Us, I listened to a podcast about that by a super fan, and if the TV series varied from the game in any way at all, like the kind of weapon used or the color of somebody's t-shirt, the superfan was extremely distressed because they're too close to it. But with Sci-Fi TV Rewatch, we get insights from a wider, you know, perspective. Bit of Plato, bit of Roman Empire. Excellent job. So, Fallout, Episode 2, The Target. Yes, there's also a dog in the game, but how or where they come from, I never really knew. Now I see how, but I still don't know why. Or what that scientist, Wildzich, injects himself with. I thought maybe they were developing disease-resistant or radioactive-resistant dogs, and Wildzich decided to literally take his own medicine, but it's not really clear. But all through the episode, people want him for whatever it is. When Lucy is standing on that sand-covered ship, it seems to be significant, but not to me. Maybe it's from one of the other games in the series. Those scenes with the skeleton family at the table are quite harsh. The show varies between almost Tom and Jerry cartoon violence to the harder-hitting, quieter parts. Lucy meets up with said dog, CX-404, and Wildzich, so there is some connection, so they're in the same part of the world. But then they part. Maximus and Knight Titus are en route to the same target, Wildzich, so it looks like all the characters are or will be at some point in the same region and meeting up. It was interesting to hear Dave's question about the armor last week. Was it really obvious that it was suit as opposed to a robot? Game players know it's a suit of armor. Maybe it wasn't really immediately clear to everybody else that that was the case. I know we saw an inert suit, but until the helmet comes off, or someone gets in or out of it, you don't really know. That, of course, is definitely revealed in this episode anyway. When they drop down from that helicopter, Maximus' nose is whacked again. He's not having much luck there. Love that oversized bag. Like in many games, there's an endless problem of wanting to collect everything of value that you see, but then it's too heavy to carry. Even if you're wearing motorized armor, there's a limit. Maximus definitely draws the short straw of investigating that cave. Having a sidekick to draw enemy attention is also a game feature. Now, today's moral is don't insult or threaten your sidekick before they save your life. I saw a great comment somewhere online that said, in the game, you can often choose a very positive or very negative and self-serving or somewhat neutral response to various events and dialogues. But here you've got all three approaches kind of represented by Lucy, positive, Ghoul, negative or self-serving, and Maximus somewhere between the two. Dave mentioned that the actor that plays Maximus looked familiar. Now, I have to say, and I have seen some comments that said, at the moment that Titus talks about the vultures coming to get you, Maximus's face looks exactly like Denzel Washington. Something about his expression, it's like there's a sad realization that now he's going to have to kill the knight, or at least let him die. He's been pushed into it. Lucy finds that sometimes her good intentions don't lead to much with that guy that drank all the water. Maximus finally gets into the armored suit. That is such a moment in the game. You never want to take it off because you don't want to be vulnerable. In his first demonstration of power, it's possible he's picked the wrong side. And what is it about this show and chickens? Some can't abide them and some get a little too close. Lucy meets Wilzig, who meets the ghoul, and it absolutely kicks off, especially when Maximus turns up. Fred commented on the violence in episode 1, and having already seen this episode 2, when I heard his feedback, I thought, he's not going to be happy. It just explodes into horrendous but darkly comic action. Wilzig loses a foot, which is bad enough, but didn't you think it was worse when they tried to put that thing back on his leg? The snake oil salesman is back with the most relentless, over-promising pitch ever. To heal anything. To heal your feet. To grow you a new one. That was great. Can a foot be regrown? That dog seemed to be dead and then not dead. It's Schrodinger's dog. Probably removing someone's head is fairly definite. Why only Zilwig's head is needed, I don't know. Something stored in his brain, in his memory. We see that the phrase, okie dokie, when delivered appropriately, can apply to almost any situation. Great episode. Take care, Alan from England.
All right, Alan in England, I'm glad I'm not the only one that thinks the actor playing Maximus looks like a young Denzel. I think that every time I see him on screen, and I don't think I'm going to stop seeing it. Schrodinger's dog, Alan, love
that
it.
That was great. Yeah, that was awesome. That was classic. That was really good. Well done.
What else about Alan's feedback?
Oh, he said, I remember why I love this podcast so much. I was literally blushing when I heard that. That was great. Thank you, Alan.
Well, that was Plato's Cave, right?
Yeah. And the skeleton family. I like how Alan pointed out. It's like, it is a very quiet scene, right? It's just there. There's not even dialogue. There's no one commenting on it. It's just visuals. But it's probably, I think, the single most powerful scene in this episode when we see the family that, and we realize that they, you know, all committed suicide.
But I think the real power comes in the rewatch once we know for sure that they killed themselves to avoid.
Right. Because the first time we see it, we're wondering, oh, what's the deal here, right?
And then right.
When we know, we see it. You're right. You're absolutely right. It's way more poignant the second time around. So, I love hearing all the stuff about the game. Alan, you're just making me want to go out and play this game for sure. I got to figure out a way to do it. I just need my son to bring his PlayStation home, as I said.
Yeah, I can't get away from Gran Turismo, so.
Have you seen the movie yet?
No, I know. See, I almost.
Oh, come on, man. You're going to love it. It's such a good movie.
So, all right. Now, Fred, the hate for 1899.
Bro, come on, Fred.
Man.
Come on, man.
We both liked it. And then, did I mishear Fred? Did he say there's less gore in episode 2?
I don't know if he said that.
I thought that's what he said. I guess I thought there was more. And
There isn't any nuclear war in this episode. So.
Well, that's true. And as Fred points out, and I think you said this as well, it's disappointing we may have seen the last of Michael Emerson's Wilzig.
We definitely have not.
Okay. I hope you're
there's
right.
There's two solid predictions from this. It's one, they're in Jersey, and two, we're going to see loads more of Michael Emerson.
Okay. Well, you know, maybe you can grow a body. You got the head. So
they could look, they made a mechanical foot for him. It's like, literally people are like coming back to life, but they put a little patch on them. So, I mean, I feel like this is kind of a place where the rules of normal physiological processes are, thrown out straight out the window. Yeah.
Yep. So, all right. Anything else about either Alan or Fred?
Fred wonders if they'll be back in Philly. I'm just thinking, well, I mean, she's, you know, traveling by foot. So I think, you know, the fact that she's traveling by foot and she can't go that far, really, that the likelihood she'll be back in Philly is, I think, fairly high. And like B, right? Like it's from a video game, and the video game has, you know, might very much reuse the setting. So I think that second part is not as strong as the first, but I think we're going to see Philly again.
Well, yeah, and I think the fact that Ma seems to be, I don't want to say necessarily a central character, but her shop seems to be, you know, perhaps a hub for, you know, information transfer and whatever. So when you couple that with the fact that Lucy and Maximus have been introduced to each other, you know, albeit, you know, clumsily. And I didn't mention this to you. I was going to ask you, did you get the damsel in distress saved by the knight vibe? Because
they turned it on its head though, right?
Yeah. And clearly she's not a damsel in distress.
Right.
I mean, you could argue, well, you know, the ghoul was going to shoot her and kill her. Fair point, but she stood strong. She was certainly not cowering in fear. Did she have time to think about, this is it, I'm going to die? Who knows? But anyway, I think once he figures out how to operate this suit, which apparently he can fly to a certain extent, you know, is he going to track her down? And, you know, you mentioned her traveling by foot over distances. Well, maybe that will play a factor. You know, it's a video game, as you said. Is she going to come across some sort of a vehicle?
Well, they barely have water, so I don't know about vehicles.
Right? Yeah, good point. So, all right, anything else?
No, I think we're good, man.
All right. Now, you know, when I was thinking about a grade for this episode, my first inclination was to go A-. But after the rewatch, I felt this episode was a lot stronger than I initially gave it credit for being. So I feel like I'm going to go full A. I really think this was a strong episode in character development, moving the plot forward. You know, you mentioned some of the mysteries that are thrown at us in this episode. So I'm going A.
Yeah. I mean, when I think of grading it down to an A-, I'm thinking, well, what would I point to as why this is not a really good episode? And then there's really nothing I can point to. I thought it was pretty good. I was engaged the whole time, went fast. Like, you know, a lot of times my kind of gauge as far as what a good episode is does it end before I realize that, you know, before I think it should be over? And it did. It went really quickly. It's nice pacing, great writing. As you said, the character development, they're really nailing it. So I liked it. Yeah. And Michael Rappaport, come on. Right. I haven't seen Michael Rappaport in ages. It's an A, without a doubt.
And they're not short episodes either. So, you know, I think that's you know, really one of the strengths is that you get to the 60-minute mark and it's like, wow, it felt like I just started. All right. Well, Fred, Alan, thank you so much for the feedback. Appreciate it as always. That'll do it for this episode of Sci-Fi TV Rewatch. Thank you for joining us. Love to hear what you think about Fallout, Black Mirror, anything going on in your genre world. Encourage you to check out the Facebook group. Sci-Fi TV Rewatch at gmail.com is the way you can reach us. We'll be back next week to talk about episode 3 of Fallout on Prime Video. But until then,
you know, it's so funny because, like, just seeing this episode reminded me of when my kids were little and kind of grew up in the cul-de-sac and I'd gather all the neighborhood kids together for, and they're like, what's a game we can play? I'm like, all right, here we go. Okay. I got 1,000 bottle caps for whoever kills that fucker, but you don't get shit if I kill him first.